This program was recorded at InterVarsity's Following Christ Conference, held in Chicago, December 27th through 31st, 2008.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the first of our elective seminar sessions. Just to make sure you're in the right place, if you're here for Christian faithfulness while accumulating advantage, you're in the right place. If not,
stay.
Stay. This is going to be great. This is going to be great. Welcome. We'll be here from 1:30 until 3 o'clock. And our presenter this afternoon is Michael Lindsay. And I realize that in the last 10 minutes, you've probably all had a chance to meet Michael. He's been very carefully working the room. But Michael is here from Houston, Texas, where he teaches sociology at Rice University. He has also traveled the halls of Baylor, Princeton, is it, and Oxford in England. And he has spent some time interviewing some of the nation's most powerful leaders, particularly looking at their faith life, their religious life. And so he's going to share some of his insights with us this afternoon on the topic, Christian faithfulness while accumulating advantage. So please welcome Michael Lindsay.
Thank you. Thanks so much, James. It's great to be here with you all. I'm going to share with you some of the research that I did for my dissertation while I was at Princeton, and which resulted in a book that I wrote called Faith in the Halls of Power, and share some of the lessons that I picked up while I was interviewing some of the different folks that I had a chance to visit with. I originally started out trying to interview 20 to 40 prominent Americans who were also evangelical Christians. That was my original proposal to my dissertation committee. And one of my committee members wrote and said, do you think you can get that many? And I said, I think I can. Anyway, I started doing the research, and it started going well, and I started getting more interviews, and then that turned into more interviews. And after a little while, I had passed the 40 mark, and they said, well, keep going, see what you can do. And I kept going, and before too much longer, I'd done about 100 interviews, and they said, wow, we didn't know there were that many out there. See what else you can do. In the end, I did 360 face-to-face interviews. It took me 3 years. I was living in Princeton, New Jersey at the time, and I made 28 transcontinental trips to the West Coast and went to 72 different research sites over the course of 3 years and logged about 300,000 frequent flyer miles, which my wife and I still enjoy to this day, which is great. A lot of people say to me, well, how did you get these interviews? I interviewed a number of different leaders. I interviewed, for example, in government. I had a chance to interview a variety of folks. I interviewed leaders in business as well as in culture. And what I want to share with you today is sort of my processing through some of the ideas that I encountered, and specifically how we as followers of Christ might think about worldly power and how we ought to respond to the advantages that come with earning a graduate degree or attending a prestigious university or landing a good internship or a good job. How do we think about that, and how do we leverage those possibilities in a way that both takes advantage of the opportunities God has given to us and yet also remains faithful and avoids the perils of privilege. I interviewed former Presidents Carter and Bush, as well as 50 cabinet secretaries, senior White House officials, and administrations from the last 8 administrations, actually. So the project begins with Jimmy Carter's election in 1976 and comes all the way up until the President administration. I also interviewed leaders in business, 101 top business leaders, presidents and CEOs mostly, but a couple of senior executives at a number of different firms, companies you would recognize, Mike Duke, the CEO, he's about to be the CEO of Walmart, he was president at the time, the head of Johnson & Johnson, New York Life, a variety of different folks, 17, 18 different industries represented. 6 of the people I sat down with are on the Forbes 400 list of wealthiest Americans. So it's a pretty elite crowd. I also interviewed folks in arts, entertainment, and media, writers, directors, producers, entertainers who've dealt with everything from Touched by an Angel to That 70s Show and everything in between, as well as professional athletes like Kurt Warner, the NFL quarterback, David Robinson, the NBA player, Tony Dungy, the coach of the Indianapolis Colts. I also interviewed leaders in the philanthropic and nonprofit sector, such as my old boss at Gallup, George Gallup, and Stephen Clapp, the dean of the Juilliard School. The thing that united all of these different people is that they were all evangelical Christians. They would call themselves evangelicals, or if they didn't call themselves that, and about a quarter of the people I interviewed said they didn't know what that term meant, or they weren't sure they wanted to be associated with it. And we talked about what that meant. They had to affirm three basic characteristics that those of us who study the literature say these are what sort of make an evangelical according to sociology standards. One is somebody who says that the Bible is the supreme religious authority in their life. So the Bible is more important than church teaching or church tradition. Two is the importance of having a born-again experience. And it can be a dramatic moment or a long process, but there is somewhere along the way, the individual says, I take ownership and claim this faith myself. It's not just something I inherited from my parents. And it's very much centered on the person of Christ. And third is having an activist witnessing faith, so wanting to bear witness in both word and deed. A lot of people say to me, how did you get some of these interviews? Because there's some pretty amazing people. One of my favorite stories, which I've told some folks, but I hope you'll indulge me, one of my favorite times about getting an interview was when I was out in Silicon Valley doing some interviews and had some time to kill. So I went over to the bookstore at Stanford University. And I've been in the bookstore for, 5 minutes or so. And I look out of the corner of my eye and I saw a woman who looked exactly like Karen Hughes. Now, I have been wanting to interview Karen Hughes. She served as counselor to the president in the current President Bush's administration, the very early stages, highest ranking woman to be appointed to a senior White House position in U.S. history. And I knew that she was a serious Christian. She had been an elder at her Presbyterian church in Austin. But at this point, she had left D.C. and had moved back to Austin. And I find that when people leave Washington, it's like they move to Barbados. They fall off the face of the earth. It's really hard to find them. And I had trouble getting access to her. And here she was in the flesh, or so I thought. She looked like Karen Hughes, but she was wearing blue jeans, and there was no entourage around her, so I wasn't really positive with this Karen Hughes. So I decided, I'm just going to sort of ease up beside her to see if I can hear her say something. And after a couple of minutes or so, I'm browsing, trying to eavesdrop as best I can. I hear her say something, and I instantly recognize that raspy Texan voice, and I thought, all right, this is Karen Hughes. It's my big break. I've been looking for an interview, and now I've got it. And in that moment, I realized I had done a lot of interviews and asked a lot of people for interviews, but I had never asked somebody face-to-face. I had sent them letters, emails, faxes, telephone calls, but I'd never asked somebody face-to-face. It's like asking somebody on a date face-to-face, you know? What if they say no, and then it'll be awkward and embarrassing, and I won't know how to respond? So I wasn't quite sure what to say, so I decided I'm going to sort of circle around her and try to get my nerve up. Stall some time a little bit. And after I circled around once, I still didn't have my nerve up, and so I decided I'm going to circle again. And I circled around Karen Hughes at the Stanford bookstore 5 times. Meanwhile, my heart is beating fast, my palms are sweating, I was getting flustered. And after the 5th time, I finally thought, you know what, I can't take this pressure. I'm a grad student. Who needs it? And I walked out of the store. And I walked out of the store, and there's a large plaza area outside the bookstore at Stanford, and as I'm standing out there, I'm just sort of thinking, what was that about? Why was I so intimidated by her? Why was her opinion of me so very important? So what if she says no? She'll forget it in 5 minutes. I'll remember it the rest of my life. So I decide that I'm going to march back into the bookstore. So I walk back into the bookstore, and I can't find her. And I thought, this is God's punishment. I didn't have enough courage early on, and now I've lost her. But after a minute or two, I notice she's upstairs in the coffee bar. So I start walking up the stairs in the coffee bar. As I'm walking up, I'm thinking, what do you call her? I mean, do I say Mrs. Hughes, Madam Counselor, Counselor Hughes, hey Karen, you know, what do I say to her? And I didn't know. And finally, I reached her, and I hadn't figured out what to call her, so I just tapped her on the shoulder. Now, I have this habit when I get nervous of getting red splotches to appear on my neck. And the moment she turned around, I felt the blood rushing up my face. And I knew I had about 60 seconds before I would be aglow. So I told her who I was, what I was doing, and how I very much wanted to interview her. And she was very nice. And she said, well, I'm out here looking at schools with my son, and I'm working on the campaign. This was in April of 2004. She said, but if you're willing to wait until late November, I'd be happy to sit down with you. gave me her phone number, and in late November of 2004, I gave her a call. I said, Mrs. Hughes, I don't know if you remember me. She said, oh, yes, the young man who turned bright red as can. I said, yes, that's me. And she said, sure, I'll be happy to sit down with you. And we did the interview in early 2005, right after the inauguration, at the Hay Adams Hotel, which is right across the street from the White House. And it was a fantastic interview, because here's a woman who had not spent her life thinking about, how do I get into the halls of power? In fact, once she got there, she was quite surprised, both at what life was like and also how she was responding to it. She found that she felt very torn because she was not having enough time with her son or her husband, and that it was quite distressing. And so thinking about how do we deal with the advantages and the possibilities that come from great opportunities and power, and at the same time remain faithful to Christ. That's what I want to talk about and share a little bit about some of the things that I happened to learn. The religious story of power is quite interesting. If you think about it in the Bible, it's a complicated situation. I mean, should believers seek worldly power, or should we shun it altogether? If you think about it in the Bible, there are a couple of stories of people of faith who rise to positions of power and prominence, or at least positions of decision-making influence. We think about Joseph, who rises up to be basically prime minister of Egypt. We think about Esther and how she's able to save the Jewish people against the evil schemes of Haman. And there are other examples, Daniel, Paul, who give witness in critical moments. But most of the time, if you're looking at the full message of the Bible, people of faith don't have a whole lot of worldly power. They are oftentimes under the thumb of Pharaoh or of Rome. One of the things that has really captured my imagination is a statement that Tim Keller made when I interviewed him for the project, because I also interviewed some religious leaders. And Tim said, what we really need to think about worldly power and how we ought to respond to it is that Christians are called to be a counterculture that works for the common good. And I think that's a helpful framework, to think of ourselves as being slightly different, but at the same time, not working for our own interests, but also for the interest of others. If you think about Jesus, Jesus has sort of a holy ambivalence to worldly power. He's clearly not impressed by it. You see that in every interaction with the Roman authorities, he's not impressed by their power or intimidated. And yet, not once does Jesus condemn the secular authorities. Not once. And it wasn't as if his disciples were not goading him along to do it. They practically begged him to do it. Why not? I think it's because Jesus knew that worldly power could in fact be harnessed to do godly good, and that there are moments in which that can actually take place. It seems to me, if you look at the gospel, that the real calling for those who have been given advantages, and make no mistake, friends, we are advantaged. Half of the world's population lives on less than $2 a day. We spend double that when we go to Starbucks. Less than 1% of the world's population goes to college. We're in the 99th percentile. We are the elite of the elite. So if we are there, what are we to do with the advantages that have come our way? It seems to me that looking at the gospel, the message is that we ought to be putting our service, our power, in the service of other people. The people that I interviewed were very interesting because their religious lives look very different than average Americans and different than average evangelicals. 53% of the people I interviewed had a born-again experience, a dramatic spiritual experience after they left home for college, after age 17. That's 8 times the level of the general population. 8 times. And it's interesting because these people also tended not to have a lot of church background. A third of them grew up in families that never went to church. So they don't know that world. It's not part of their background. 59% of the people that I interviewed switched denominations quite regularly. There's very low denominational loyalty among the people I interviewed. They really don't care. And yet they're pretty serious about their faith. 93% of them say that they bear witness to their faith, so much so that their colleagues know what they believe and why, and that they can talk about it, and often do. So it's not that they are moving away from some of the central ideas of what it means to be a follower of Christ, but they do Christianity a little bit different than a lot of us do. And that was something that was surprising to me. 1/3 of them said that ambition is a spiritual challenge in their life. Ambition is a spiritual challenge. And so we have to think about what that might mean. There's lots of ways in which evangelicals can do an awful lot of good. Let me just mention three very quick examples of people that I interviewed who I thought had done some amazing things. One is that in politics, most people assume that what evangelicals have done over the last 30 years is all about abortion and same-sex marriage. That if there's any, you know, policy gains that evangelicals have made, maybe it's on the abortion debate. I've got to tell you, I look at the data and look at the time sequence, and I'm just not convinced that there's been a whole lot of movement, really, in that particular area. But there is one issue where evangelicals have done an awful lot of very good work, and it's around the issue of religious freedom. Over the late 80s and early 90s, a group of evangelicals began to discuss how important they thought religious freedom ought to be as a tenet of American foreign policy. They began building some coalitions with a broad array of different religious groups, not just fellow Christians, but working with Muslims and Hindus and Buddhists. And in 1998, they successfully lobbied the passage of the International Religious Freedom Act, the most sweeping piece of legislation that deals with religious issues that has happened in any of our lifetimes. Very significant. It did several things, one of which was it set up an independent commission that investigates abuses of religious freedom around the world. That commission then reports their findings to the Secretary of State in an annual report that they write. And the State Department uses the diplomatic tool of name them and shame them. It produces a list of countries that do not allow religious freedom. And it says, you guys need to change your ways. And amazingly enough, when the State Department of the United States puts you on the name them, shame them list, countries listen. And in places like Laos and Vietnam, we've actually seen over the last 10 years some real adjustments that have occurred related to religious freedom. Critics have said, well, it doesn't have enough teeth to it. It hasn't done anything. You know, it's just a list. Well, it's interesting to see the way in which that list is taken seriously in internal dynamics within the government. 3 years ago, the State Department added Saudi Arabia to that list. Now, we have a complicated relationship with Saudi Arabia. So for that to have taken place is quite significant. Religious freedom is something that not only has advantaged or protected Christian missionaries in Southeast Asia and Africa and around the world, it's also provided religious freedom for Muslims, Hindus, and Buddhists. Carrie Barris here, and there were two times when I went out on a book tour last fall talking about my book where I got heckled. One was in Berkeley, California at Black Oak Books, which was a very interesting experience, and the other place was at the 92nd Street Y in Manhattan. Now, the 97th Street Y is a celebrated place to launch your book. My publisher was thrilled when they wanted to do this. And we were pretty stoked about it as well. The same night I was launching my book, Alan Greenspan was launching his book in the other room. And my wife kept trying to get the media confused to come over to our room. Which was great. And for the first time, I'm standing there and I'm talking about some of the research I've come across, and a woman heckles me from the audience. And pretty quickly, the audience sort of turned against me. And it was a fairly hostile crowd. It's not the kind of crowd that is excited about evangelicals moving into the halls of power. And there was a panel that was joining me. One guy, David Frum, who had worked in the Bush White House, who is not a Christian, and then another guy named Rabbi David Saperstein, who is a lobbyist for the Jewish community. He's been there for a long time. And I was trying to think, what could I say that sort of turned this around? I want to turn the tide because It was looking as if evangelicals have done lots of bad things, and I wanted to sort of give a different message. And I turned to David Saperstein and I said, Rabbi, would you mind telling me a little bit about what you think about Bob Seipel? And it's interesting because I knew enough. Bob Seipel had served as the CEO of Parker Brothers Games and of Lennox China, and then he was recruited to serve as the CEO of, Bob Seipel served as the president of Eastern University, and then he was president of World Vision, and then he was recruited to be the first ambassador at large for international religious freedom. So he's the first person that's set up by this Religious Freedom Commission. And I knew that he'd done a very good job of building relationships with particularly the Jewish community. And Rabbi Saperstein, from the stage of the 97th Street Y, said, if there were more evangelicals like Bob Seipel, there'd be a lot more conversions. And why? It's because by building bridges and alliances, it had really changed some of the perceptions within the Jewish community of what evangelicals have done, because they were not just looking out for their own interests, but were actually working for the common good. You can see similar kind of developments that have occurred in other sectors. For example, the ability to express your faith in the workplace. This is probably the biggest change from when I entered the corporate world 15 years ago. In 1997, President Clinton issued an executive order that's changed the way in which religion could be discussed, or at least formalized in how it could be discussed in the federal workplace. Now, this is significant because however the federal workplace goes, so goes corporate America. And what he did is he said that if you can talk about other parts of your life in the workplace, then you can talk about religion. So if you can have a cartoon or a picture of your kids in your cubicle, you can also have a Bible verse or a cross. That was a freedom of expression, and you should be allowed to do that. If you could talk about, you know, the college game you went to on Saturday around the lunch table on Monday, then you should also be able to talk about your church service. And corporate America has responded quite significantly. There are Bible study groups that occur in the workplace during lunch and before and after work at pretty much every Fortune 500 company. In most organizations, there's some kind of way in which you can have spiritual expression. And it's not just allowing freedom of expression for Christians. It's also allowing, there are Torah classes, for example, on Wall Street for Jews who want to learn more about their own tradition. There's a whole variety of different things that have occurred. But principally, it was a group of evangelicals who began lobbying within a Democratic administration to see if President Clinton would make some adjustments. And in fact, it has changed the landscape of corporate America. A third and final case would be an example of how scholarly breakthroughs have worked not only for our own interests, but also the common good. I am so stoked that Francis Collins is speaking tonight because I was really excited about getting to interview him for my book. I went down to Washington and did the interview. Francis Collins, of course, led the five different teams that mapped the human genome, the most significant scientific discovery in our lifetimes. And he's also a serious Christian. And for the first 50 minutes of the interview, I told him, you know, we did the typical questions I asked of everyone. And then I closed my notebook and I said, Dr. Collins, I want to save the last 10 minutes for me. And he said, okay. And I said, let me tell you our story. My wife and I have a little girl who's about 18 months old, and something is wrong with her. And we don't know what it is, but our suspicion is that there's an underlying genetic abnormality. And we have taken her to scores of different doctors, and we have not gotten any answers. Do you think that some of the research that you and your colleagues did might be able to help us get answers? And he said, you know, Michael, I don't think there's currently something that's available to you, but there are some research tests that are going on. And he said, my hunch is that within 18 to 24 months, there will probably be something that's available on the commercial market. I did that interview in September of 2005. And Rebecca and I had that test performed on Elizabeth earlier this year. I'm the personal beneficiary of this man's scientific work. And he says he couldn't have done it had it not been for his underlying commitment to God and the way in which God sustained him in the scholarly work he was doing. That's a good story. That's a counterculture working for the common good. And so I think there's some real hopeful, bright signs, ways in which we can really make some promising developments. But there are also some real perils that come with privileges and some of the real challenges that we might face. For example, relational hazards. I was struck by how many people that I interviewed, I would ask them questions. I asked one question, which would, about a third of the people, when I asked that question, they would actually break down into tears in the interview. The question was, has your rise to influence ever cost you something personally? And something about the way that question was phrased and when it came in the interview, it just struck a chord with a number of people I knew. Who then began to tell stories about failed marriages, damaged relationships with their kids, with their parents, broken relationships in the workplace, a whole variety of things. One of the real corroding influences of power is that it can become all-consuming. And it can then invariably influence your relationships with other people. As we know, the tendency in powerful circles is to constantly sort of be looking around and trying to curry favor with other people. And yet we know that runs counter to the gospel. There are no ordinary people. Everyone has an extraordinary story, and we have to treat them in that way. One of the things that I learned that was actually most pernicious, and if I had to give one, I'll give you some little tidbits of advice that I encountered. And one of those is that the crucible of power is very difficult for marriages. And the reason is very simple. One spouse is getting amazing opportunities. They're getting the chance to do some cool things and meet amazing people and have great experiences. And if there's one pitfall, it's that they don't bring their spouse along in that process.
And this creates a division. So that eventually, you've got one business leader who is being invited to go to the White House, who's meeting with the Secretary General of the UN, and who's basically doing all these amazing things that you hear about in the nightly news, but you don't actually personally experience. Meanwhile, his wife is not experiencing any of that, doesn't understand that world, because she's busy changing the kids' diapers and figuring out, you know, how to make soup for the kids. That's one of the biggest challenges, is how can you accumulate advantages in such a way that you bring both partners along? Because that's where real breaking points occurred in a number of the people that I interviewed. Another thing that I would say is a real challenge is that there are some wasted opportunities in poor stewardship. It was amazing because I asked the question of every person I interviewed, I said, how powerful are you? What can you do? And you know what these people would say? Nothing. I have no power at all. I am so constrained, my board, I've got these customers, I can't do anything. One guy said to me, you know, I think that my secretary has more power than I follow her orders. I said to him, you're CEO of a company that employs 50,000 people. You have some influence over those lives. You know, don't you think that you're part of that? A number of people I interview don't even sort of see the opportunities that they have. They're so focused on sort of how constrained they personally are and don't recognize there's lots of opportunities that come along in the process. And that's a real challenge, a real peril. There's also the issue of how we can develop a calloused heart, or we can become what I've called a gated community of the soul. This is probably one of the most troubling elements, I have to say, about people I interview, is how many of them have become disconnected from local religious bodies, basically from the church. We know from sociological research that the church has historically been one of the very few social institutions in America that has been successfully able to bridge socioeconomic divides. Historically, the church was the one place where the bank president and the bank teller knew each other, not just as fellow employees, but actually as people. They knew each other's names and interacted with them. A number of the people that I interviewed have not followed in that direction. They've become less engaged with their church, and they've been developing their spiritual life, but it tends to occur in enclaves, in different categories, that frankly fits their lifestyle, but also comes with some real challenges. There is a very common issue is that it's very difficult for the people I interview to be a leader at their local church, to serve on the board of elders, board of deacons. Why? Because many of those require attending once a month or once a week a regular meeting. And you know what? These people are not in the same place every week or every month. So they say, I'm on the board of deacons, and I haven't been to a deacons meeting in 3 years because I'm in Dallas or Dubai or Delhi. I'm all over the place. And so what they have found in lieu of those kinds of opportunities is they've formed a number of different spiritual formation groups that oftentimes meet over a weekend or a particular day, and then they do that once or twice a year, and then the rest of the year they meet as a small group over the telephone. They telecommute. And some of these CEOs that we heard literally are getting up at 2 a.m. when they're in India to call into their fellowship group so they can have that kind of spiritual community. That's a very good thing, but the challenge is that you can find yourself surrounded by just people who come from the same celebrated world that you do, and you lose touch with reality. One of the persons who really impressed me, who has avoided that pitfall, is Dick DeVos. Dick DeVos comes from a family that lives in Grand Rapids that Forbes estimates their family net worth to be at about $3 billion. They own a lot and have been very successful. And Dick DeVos ran for governor in Michigan a couple of years ago.
Didn't win, by the way.
Did not win, that's right. But he did run. And when I did the interview with him, I asked him, how do you stay real? How do you keep your faith real in these different contexts? And he said, my wife and I made a decision a number of years ago that we were going to be involved in a small group in our church, and we were going to take whatever group they assigned us to. And he said, so we're in a group that has lots of different people, but none of the people in our small group come from the same social worlds that we do. And we have a habit within our small group to go around the circle every week and sort of tell about what our week has been like and then share some prayer requests. And he said, the first meeting of this was very awkward. Because he said, Betsy and I were wondering, are we really going to tell them what we've done? I mean, he said, quite literally that week they had sat beside the president and his wife at a dinner. and they had been to some launch of an event in New York. I mean, just they were living a lifestyle that you read about on Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, right? Not the kind of thing that somebody's in a small group with. And he said, but we decided that that was what we ought to do. And so he said, we just sort of shared our lives. I interviewed him on a Thursday, and the night before he had a small group meeting, and I said, what happened last night? And he said, well, we did the same thing where we go around the circle and sort of tell what we can do. And he said, there was a couple in our class, in our group, and the husband told us that day he found out he was being laid off on the job. And his wife stays at home with their one-year-old kid, and he said, they asked us to pray because they're frankly concerned about how they're going to pay their rent. Because it's they live on a short margin. And I said, what does it mean for somebody like you to be in a small group with somebody like this? And he said, it's quite simple. He said, they being in our small group reminds us that there are people who really do have these struggles, and it helps us remain be connected with reality. So that's one of the great temptations of power and privilege, is you lose touch with reality. And he said, our being in that group reminds them that money doesn't solve the problems. It just creates difference. The perils that come with privilege are things that we have to really be intentional in thinking about. And it's very common among high-achieving people to make an idol of our performance. The temptation, frankly, to make God in our own image, which happens to look like our achievements and our accomplishments. The problem is that I interviewed some amazingly famous and powerful people, and yet they all tell the same story about being on a treadmill that they feel like they cannot get off. In fact, I interviewed a couple of people. Bud McFarland was one person I interviewed. Remember Bud McFarland? He served as National Security Advisor under President Reagan. A very impressive man, served as a White House fellow, a brilliant man. And he was the chief architect behind the Iran-Contra scheme. And he said, you know, I wasn't just involved. He said, I planned it all. And as a result, he was called to testify before Congress, and he had to step down. And I asked him, what did this cost you? And he said, you know, it cost me all the things that I had spent my life working for. It gave me a whole new life. I was able to get off the treadmill. So I thought I had been leaning my whole life on going up this ladder that was getting higher and higher, and yet I didn't feel like I was even living the life I wanted to live. It's very common among high-achieving people, whether you're a graduate student, or a faculty member, or a businessman, or a Hollywood star, to make an idol of our performance. And these issues, broken relationships, wasted opportunity, insensitivity, and self-sufficiency, these are real perils that we face when we have the privileges that come along with secular and worldly power. And yet at the same time, we know that there can be a real fleeting nature to worldly power. This is James Baker. James Baker is an interesting man. He served as, I think he actually has held more senior positions in the executive branch than anybody else who's alive, I think. He served as Assistant Secretary of Commerce, Secretary of State, Secretary of Treasury. He served as White House Chief of Staff under two different administrations. He also directed five different presidential campaigns over the last 30 years. So he's achieved amazing opportunities. He's had a lot of different experiences. And in the process, knows a good bit about worldly power. He told a story when he gave a talk at the National Prayer Breakfast, which incidentally he told me this one talk that he gave back in 1991 by the Secretary of State. He said, that's the most requested talk I've ever given in my career. He said, nobody asked me for copies of my policy talks or different things I did in the White House. They all want this particular talk. And I said, well, what do you think is so compelling about it? He said, well, I told the story in there, which was revealing, but I think was actually helped me sort of come into contact with my own faith. So tell me about it. He said, one day, I was on my way to the White House. I was serving as President Reagan's chief of staff. And he said, as we were driving down Pennsylvania Avenue, the driver was taking me. I was in the back of the government-issued car. And he said, it was about 6:30 in the morning. It was still dark. It was a cold winter day. There was some fog. And I couldn't make out a whole lot. He said, as we were driving up, I looked out the window, and I saw a man who I instantly recognized. And I realized he had served as White House Chief of Staff under one of the former administrations. And he said, in that moment, it dawned on me that here's a guy who, just a few years ago, was holding the exact same position that I now have. That A few years ago, he could have been sitting in this very same seat in this car on the way to the very same office. And yet, as I'm looking now, there's no pomp and circumstance, there's no entourage, there's just a single man walking alone with his thoughts. See, I realized in that moment that no matter what kind of worldly power of opportunities have come along, frankly, it's really fleeting. And so one of the things that we have to sort of think about as Christians who want to try and take advantage of the moment that you've been given is to think really strategically about the preparation phase of what you're going through, but also recognizing that whatever comes in that particular moment is short-lived. Now, here's the problem with that short-lived nature. A lot of people sort of live their life constantly on hold. That they say to themselves, you know, life is really crazy right now while I'm in grad school. And so I don't have time to develop the relationships. I don't have the time to develop the spiritual disciplines. I don't have the time to do these other things. But as soon as I finish my dissertation, I'm going to sort of have a chance to start a new phase. I won't be under the thumb of my professor, and I'll be able to do something new. And so they say, I'm going to just put that on hold. The problem is that once you realize, when you cross to the other side of the desk, actually the work is entirely different, but it's a lot worse. Because now, you're not just doing your work, but you're responsible for other people's work, right? So you've got to respond, you get feedback and encourage and teach, and you have all these other things. And so these people say to themselves, you know what, I'm just gonna try and do as best I can right now until I get tenure. And then once I get tenure, it's going to be a lot better. I know it, I'll feel like I got freedom, and everything will be a lot better. And this works for folks in the academy, it works for my friends who are in law, who say, just once I make Parker, right, once I get to this, the problem is that we're talking about something that's 5, 6, 7 years away. In the meanwhile, you're developing habits of lifestyle that get ingrained into your soul. And it's very hard to break free of them after 5 to 6 years. We are what we continually do. Excellence is a habit. It's a big thing to live out. So how do we think about all of the privileges and, frankly, the virtues? How can we have a virtuous lifestyle, even while we have some of the advantages that come along our way? Well, one of the things that we have to remember is that we tend to think of virtues as like an action, like you do the right ethical thing. That's not what virtues are at all. Virtues are instead understood to be sort of moral excellence and goodness. It's an entire tendency, an inclination, an orientation for your life, which means that it takes control over everything. It's not just one particular part. It's not just what you do on Sunday morning, but it influences everything that you do in your life. So if that's the case, if that's how virtues are, how do we get to where we are today? Well, we know that the idea of virtues comes from the Greeks, right? So Plato, and classical virtues. Plato had this idea that the virtuous life was one of balance. And he said that what you want to do is avoid the extremes. So he said, really what you want to have as a virtue is temperance. You want to avoid polar opposites. You're looking for this balance in between, called the golden mean. Or prudence, which is where you're not too slow that you can't make a decision, but you're not rash also and always making the fastest action. You're prudent. You use good judgment. Or fortitude. Or justice. Now that's sort of the classical heritage into which most of the New Testament writers were sort of formed and shaped. So how does virtues come to us in the biblical tradition? Well, if you think about it, there's lots of different places in the New Testament in particular where we hear different virtues, right? So in Philippians 4, whatever is good, true, beautiful, noble, think on these things. When we think about the fruit of the Spirit that's listed, Galatians 5:23, love, joy, peace, patience, all these sorts of things. 1 Corinthians 13:13. Faith, hope, love, the grace of Jesus, love. Different virtues that we are called to incorporate, to bear witness to in our life. And there are other virtues that you can see, particularly from Proverbs, which is wisdom and courage. So these virtues are called to be part of our life. How do we actually get them into our life on a regular basis? I've been reading recently the writings of a Catholic theologian named Romano Guardini. And he wrote a little book that I encourage you to check out called Learning the Virtues. Now, when I looked at this book, I looked at it for one reason. I wanted to read what he had to say about the virtue of patience, because I have none. And I thought, my wife tells me I need to develop this. And so I thought that's what I would go to sort of see with Gardenia. A friend of mine had sort of sent it to me this way. And so I opened it up to look at that particular chapter. I happened to notice the chapter that immediately preceded the chapter on patience. And it's on the virtue of acceptance. And I have to say, when I read that, I was sort of intrigued, because I don't really think of acceptance as a virtue. When I think of acceptance, I think of sort of laissez-faire, let people do whatever they want, tolerance, accepting, whatever it might be. I didn't want to be one who was necessarily accepting of what I see around us, the moral freefall, the lack of traditional values. I don't want to accept that. That's not what Gardenia is talking about. What he says is that there are three forms of acceptance that we have to do before we can actually live out the virtue of patience. One is that we have to accept ourselves. And this is the hardest one for people who are high achievers. Accepting the self. Most people say that they are motivated by what they see other people, what other people see in them. Most people say, getting the, if you ask high achieving people, they'll say to you, what I'm really compelled by is affirmation. And so if somebody claps and says you did a good job, then that really motivates me. I think that's actually only half of the story. I think really what it is we want people to reflect back to us what we want to see in ourselves. That we hold ourselves, particularly high achieving people, hold ourselves to much higher standards than anybody else does, right? And there's a perfectionism that settles in, and we want other people to feed that back to us, to see that our perfection is recognized by other people. And Gardini says, we did it all wrong. He said, you know, we tend to see ourselves as wanting to live up to this perfection, and then we get frustrated by our limitations. He said, the limitations are actually our distinctive natures. It's our limitations, our shortcomings, that's what makes us unique. You don't see that as the bane of your existence, it's the blessing. Why? Because the limitations rein in the bad vices that creep into our lifestyle. Why are we called to practice the Sabbath? It's not so that we sort of say to God, you're important in our life. That's not what it is. Jesus clearly teaches us. That's not what it's about. The Sabbath is there as a way of forcing us to recognize we can't do it all. It's a recognition of human finitude on a regular basis. So Gardini said, we first have to accept ourselves. The second thing we have to do is accept the situation. And this is where I think we really need to adjudicate opportunities that come along our way, and also points where we're trying to sort of push a bit too hard. This is why 35% of people I interviewed say ambition is a spiritual struggle in their life. Why is it a spiritual struggle? Because it's tough to figure out, am I getting this opportunity because God's brought it into my life, or because I've been pushing this door for so long it finally opened up? I was having a conversation with a colleague recently, because I had done a grant application, and I didn't get it, and I was pretty bummed about it. And we were talking a little bit about it, and I realized in that conversation with her that in some ways not getting this particular thing I thought I really wanted was sort of freeing in some ways. It sort of took a bit of a weight off of me. It's never good to not get something you really want, but at the same time, those limitations, accepting the situation you're in, can actually be very helpful for you. Speaking just personally, so as I've been doing this research on powerful people, I've had this, it's been wonderful, things have gone well professionally. But I would have willingly given all of those types of things up if things could have just been normal with our daughter, Elizabeth. And I say that very honestly. If there was in some way in God's calculus, I could sort of take the good stuff from this side and just have it applied over here so that Elizabeth could be a typical kid, I totally would do it. Gardini has helped me to see, though, that actually getting to a point of accepting the situation into which God has placed for whatever reason it happens to be, once you get that, you can start to actually live out a more virtuous life. Because it places you, once you get to a point of acceptance, it also naturally brings you to a point of gratitude. And then that becomes a wellspring for your life, not a drain sink that everything gets stuck in. And I'm still, frankly, in this moment of wanting very much and yet trying to also see what is God doing in our particular lifestyle. I'll tell you just one little side story which has been kind of fun. Our daughter goes to a special education school at the Jewish Community Center. Now let me tell you, this place is as Jewish as InterVarsity is Christian. They have a weekly Shabbat service. When they say congratulations, they say Mazel Tov. They learn the Hebrew alphabet. They sing dreidel, dreidel, the whole thing. We lived in New Jersey for 10 years, but we are far more part of the Jewish subculture in Houston, Texas than we ever were outside of New York. And one of the things that my wife and I have been talking about is, how do you get to this point where you accept the situation in which you find yourself? And how do you sort of take the present moment and try and say, God, things that are not so good, can you make some good out of this? Rebecca, my wife, who's a saint, she should really be the one who talks, not me, decided in August that she wanted to host a coffee for the moms that their kids are in the same class with Elizabeth. And she said, I just think that they're craving for some community. And she said, I would much rather be hanging out with the cute little moms from our church school. They're people that they're my kind of people. And she said, this other crowd, I don't really know how to relate to them, except that we have kids who have issues. She said, so I'm just going to try it out. And about half the class, the moms stay at home, and about half the class, the moms are professionals. And I mean, they're serious professionals, lawyers, doctors, a variety of different things. So she has this coffee. All of them come. Every one of them comes. And Rebecca said to me that morning while she was getting ready, she said, I'm going to have some breakfast kind of food, and I'm thinking about saying a blessing. And I said, are you sure about that? I said, no, remember, love. I said, they are Jewish in ethnicity, but not necessarily in faith. Most of them are not actually practicing Jews. And I said, let's think carefully about this. And she said, well, I really feel like that maybe God wants me to do something here to be a witness and witness. I said, okay. So she goes to, moms are there, and right before they start digging in, Rebecca says, I'd like us to say a blessing, if that's okay, before we eat. And, the moment she said that, sort of the mom sort of got quiet. And one woman said, what? What did you say? and then another woman said, what did you say? We're going to pray? We're going to pray to Jesus, Buddha? What is this about? And Rebecca said, in that moment, I was really intimidated. I thought, this is going to be awkward. I don't know if this is really what I want to do. But I really want to be. It's going to be embarrassing. How am I going to do it? She said, miraculously, I said, we're going to pray to God. And that seemed to calm some of their concerns. So she said, let's pray. And she decided, in that prayer, she said, I decided we need to pray for the teachers in the school, and I need to pray for the kids. So she prayed for each child by name. And she said, amen, she looked up, and there were a couple of moms who were crying. One of the moms came over and said to her, I've never prayed for my child, or have my child. Rebecca, we got into bed that night. I said, well, do you feel like you did the right thing? And she said, absolutely. She said, let me tell you what happened the rest of the story. She said, so I had been praying that I would do the right thing and that we would sort of accept the situation and try and flourish, to bloom where we're planted. And she said, Elizabeth, my daughter, said, Mom, for the first time. She said, it was as if God was sort of giving me an affirmation that what we had done was going in the right direction. Now, I don't know if in God's cosmic calculus this was all planned, but I got to tell you, for us, that was a real sign of confirmation. And it really spoke to us. Accepting the situation, Barthini says that's fundamental to the virtuous lifestyle. And thirdly, accepting society. And this doesn't mean that we try and accept everything that's out there, that we say, God bless you all who, curse God, and God bless you for all the bad things that you do. No, it's not saying that at all. We're still working for change. But it is one that recognizes that if we want to be a counterculture that works for the common good, we have to be one that sort of takes people where they are and says, we're going to be friends and love you for who you are. And in the process, change might just come. And that's what's happened. Two of the moms that are in this Jewish community center are going to my wife's Bible study fellowship for mothers of preschoolers at our church. And they're going because they're craving community. And I don't know if they're going to convert or not, but I can tell you that change occurs when we build bridges. And that, to me, is the most important thing. How do we be a counterculture for the common good? We have to do things a little bit differently. So there have to be moments when we're willing to take a stand, to say, my faith compels me to do something. Sometimes it's simple as saying a prayer in a hostile environment, or sometimes it's doing something much more courageous. And at the same time, we're working for the common good, trying to build relationships and developing friendships along the way. Niebuhr, the one who came up with the Serenity Prayer. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. If I had to say what trips up more leaders with the advantages that have come their way, and there may be people who, go to Harvard, get a White House fellowship, end up becoming CEO of a company. What trips them up is that they can't get these three simple things down. They can't get to the point where they accept the things that cannot change, whether it be their families, their lives, or where God has placed them. Or they don't take the courage to change the things that they have the opportunity to make a stand, to do something for God's good. Or they don't have the wisdom to know the difference between those two. There are some amazing people I had the chance to interview. Amazing people who've done some wonderful things that have served not just the Christian community, but have also served the common good. There are also some rotten apples in the mix, and I learned some interesting lessons about that. The people who most impressed me were ones that had figured out how to bring those virtues into their life, and frankly, how to sort of mesh faith and power together. We get the term religion from the Latin religio, to bind together. The interesting thing is that, unlike other forms of identity, religion is a distinctive characteristic. I'm a sociologist, so it's interesting to see that if you want to predict how somebody will hold a particular attitude on a public issue, name the public issue that's in the public square today, you want to figure it out. It is religion that determines that outcome more significantly than race, gender, ethnicity, region of the country, level of education, socioeconomic status, or family background. Religion, it has this powerful effect. One of the things that I found is that a number of the people I interviewed try to bear witness in subtle ways, but yet still powerful ways. One of the CEOs, I mentioned in the Day Ahead conference, one of the CEOs who I was interviewing, he had to step out of the office to take a telephone call. And I was sitting there in the guest chair, and I was looking, and there's a large bookcase behind his desk. And as I'm just, sitting there, daydreaming, whatever, I start noticing the books that are on the bookcase. And there are these books about strategy and markets and all the kind of things you would see from Harvard Business School Press. And then there are a couple of books there that relate to this particular industry. And then I notice a book by Max Locato that's on the shelf, pastor from San Antonio. And then I look a little bit further down, there's another couple of books by Chuck Swindoll. Now that's interesting. Why are those books there? So he comes back in the office. And I asked him about it. I said, do you use those books in company speeches? Do you quote from them in your corporate newsletters or something? And he said, no, typically I read those when I travel or sometimes on the weekend. But I made a decision a number of years ago that I would try and bring some of those into the office and just have them on bookcase as a way to signal my faith to other folks who come and visit. And I said, does anybody ever notice? And he said, well, you just did. What I found is that these signals are all over the place. They're ways in which people try to bear witness. Now, one of the temptations about this sort of signaling is that the signal can get so soft that you can't actually tell that someone's actually bearing witness. That's one of the challenges. That a lot of my friends, mainline Protestant ministries on campus, have long said that the principal form of their ministry is a ministry of presence. And I said, well, the problem is that nobody knows you're actually present. You've got to actually have some kind of, there has to be some recognition. So signals only work unless they're picked up
in the process.
But this is a way in which people have tried to bear witness in very subtle ways, and yet at the same time with some kind of significance. There's also this element that I came across, that a number of the people I interviewed have what I call a cosmopolitan faith. Cosmopolitan is a Greek word we get from Diogenes the Cynic, who described himself as a citizen of the world. The people I interviewed are worldly in the very best sense of the term. They're not caught up in the sort of navel-gazing that occurs in a lot of churches in the evangelical subculture. Day in and day out, they're rubbing shoulders with people of different faith and of no faith at all. And so they just don't care about some of the parochial issues that we debate sometimes. They're on to bigger issues. It's interesting because most of the people I interview are not culture warriors who want to sort of take back the country for their faith. They have a more modest goal. They want their faith to be seen as authentic, as reasonable, and as winsome. And they're working to try and do that. And one of the things that I think is very helpful is that a cosmopolitan faith is one that builds bridges and looks for ways in which you can have real opportunities. And so I think that that's probably an appropriate way, particularly in the halls of power, where there tends to be some of the great challenges. The three main areas where character flaws happen most often: sex, salary, and status. They get people in trouble most of the time. If you had to say what causes a leader's downfall, it's one of these particular areas: sex, salary, or related to money, or status, fame. And one of the interesting things is trying to think about how do you actually steward power and influence and fame that comes along when you hadn't quite been expecting it. How do you do that? One of the persons that I'll just say, I have to say I'm fairly impressed with, who sort of fits this particular context, is Rick Warren. Now, Rick Warren, in 2000, was a well-known evangelical megachurch pastor, right? So he had written The Purpose-Driven Church, and a lot of pastors knew about him. But he was basically unknown to the rest of the American world. Most people did not know who Rick Warren was. And then he happens to write a book that does marginally well, Purpose-Driven Life, sells 30 million copies, becomes the best-selling book in publishing history. And suddenly, he is a recognized celebrity. I opened my book with a vignette. I got invited to a party. A friend of mine heard that Rupert Murdoch. Murdoch owns News Corp, which owns HarperCollins, which owns Zondervan, which published The Purpose-Driven Life. And they were throwing a party atop 30 Rockefeller Plaza. That's the building that the Today Show is in. It's on the very top floor in what used to be known as the Rainbow Room. They were throwing a party for him to celebrate the 20 millionth copy of The Purpose-Driven Life being sold. And a friend of mine said, "Do you want to go?" I said, "Rupert Murdoch is throwing a party for an evangelical megachurch pastor from Southern California atop 30 Rockefeller Plaza in Midtown Manhattan. I'm there." And it was great because there were two crowds that were invited to this party. There was the publishing elite crowd of New York, which largely come from News Corp. And then there was all the evangelical friends of Rick Warren that were there. And they mixed together like water and oil. And so you would go around and, you know, mix and mingle. And because I was living in Princeton, New Jersey, people would say to me, "What do you do?" And I would say, "I live in Princeton." And invariably, they assumed that I was part of the publishing elite crowd somehow. And so there was a woman who was dressed in all black. She had black glasses. She sort of fit the image of sort of the power editor of a major press in New York. She just looked the part. And we're talking, and she said, "So tell me, Michael, do you know any of these evangelicals?" Like it's some alien species or something. And I said, "Well, yeah, I do." And she said, "Could you introduce me to one?" And I learned that she had done her undergrad at Yale, and there was a friend of mine, Mark Berner, who was standing nearby, and I knew that Mark had gone to Yale. And so I said, "Let me introduce you to Mark." And so I bring her over, and I said, "Mark, this is this woman, and you all both went to Yale, and I thought you all might have some common interests." And she said, "Now, are you an evangelical?" And he said, "Yeah, I think, you know, depending on how you find it, yeah, basically so." And she said, "Are there a lot of evangelicals at Yale?" So it's interesting to see sort of how things have really changed. The reason why I am, on the whole, impressed with what I've seen with Rick Warren is that he sort of followed the playbook of Billy Graham, which is, if you're going to have power and opportunity, and the likelihood of any of us in here sort of
selling a book that will sell 30 million copies is probably pretty small. But you might actually find yourself having more privileges and opportunities than you ever expected. Most of the people I interviewed are in that boat. Most of the people I interviewed didn't expect to be, you know, eating in the White House mess or to be in the executive suite of a Fortune 500 company. So how do you deal with that when it comes? There are a couple of things that I found to be particularly helpful among the people that impressed me more. And one of them is the idea of having accountability. And this is not cheesy accountability groups from youth group that I'm talking about. This is having deep friendships. People who can ask the hard questions in your life, and that you in turn can ask hard questions of them. Having a sense of being transparent is very important. There are a number of people that I interviewed that I have to say do this quite well. Dennis and Eileen Bakke. Dennis was the CEO of AES, at one time the world's largest privately held energy company based in Washington. And one of the decisions that Dennis and Eileen made is that they would not make personal financial decisions without getting approval from a group of folks who were in their small group, who could ask them the hard questions. At the time I was doing the interview with Dennis, they had a pool in their house, and it had gotten this big crack. And he said, it's not good for us to use the pool because of this crack. This would cost $40,000 for us to fix the pool. And I said, well, what did you do? And he said, well, we took it to our accountability group. He said, we don't write checks above a certain amount without them saying this is you know, an appropriate use of money. That takes a lot of transparency and accountability, because most people, we don't open up our checkbooks for other people to scrutinize. Especially not when you have lots of disposable income. And that's what they chose to do. Accountability, transparency, I found to be a very important way in which people sort of navigated faith and power. At the same time, generosity. I found that there was a strong correlation between people who were exceptionally generous and people who seemed to exude deep, vibrant faith. The people that impressed me the least tended to be the people who were the stingiest Christians in town. It's amazing because now with GuideStar and a variety of different online searches, you can actually find out basically how much money people give away. And I did a lot of research on the people I interviewed. And there was a tight correlation between sort of people that did not impress me in the one-on-one interaction when I asked them about their spiritual lives and actually the stinginess that was reflected in their giving. Something about generosity sort of transforms our hearts and opens us up to spiritual virtues in important ways.
And then finally, having a degree of humility. And how do you develop humility? The nice thing about this is that these three sort of antidotes respond to those three areas of concern, right? So accountability can help you avoid the pitfalls of sex, and generosity can help you avoid the pitfalls of salary, and humility can help you avoid the pitfalls of status. How do you do that? Well, typically, the person who helped more of the leaders that I interviewed to remain humble was their spouse. Typically, that their spouse helped them sort of keep on the straight and narrow, and not everybody I interviewed was married, but they found they had somebody in their life who helped them sort of practice humility on a regular basis so that they didn't get too big for their britches. And in fact, that was sort of the key to handling the advantages that come along and yet still remaining faithful to Christ in the midst of the power and influence that they have to be. Well, that at least gives you some of the interesting things that happened to learn. We wanted to save some time for some conversation, questions that you might have. Who's got the first question? Yes, ma'am.
I have a quick one. You mentioned the principle of power being bring your spouse along. I wondered, as you have gone around and increased your own access to power, how have we been practicing your own life?
Yeah, I'll say that particular issue and sort of Sabbath keeping are probably the two things that I sort of changed my own lifestyle in response to what I was observing in my research. Very practical things. So that I work very hard whenever I get sort of a cool opportunity, whether it be sort of a neat speaking opportunity or a chance to meet somebody, I try to figure out a way to see if my wife can come along. Because I feel like that's really important. And then there are some things that happen that I don't expect, and I sort of make it a habit that I call Rebecca immediately when it happens. So I'll give you a very tangible example. I'm doing some research right now on the White House Fellows Program. It's an amazing program. It's been around for 45 years, and it takes people who are in their 30s, gives them a chance to work with a senior White House official or cabinet secretary for 1 year, and then they take that knowledge back to whatever they were doing beforehand. And it's very impressive people.
And I'm doing interviews with the current class of fellows. One of the guys was head of the Navy SEALs in Iraq. I realized he could kill me while I was sitting across, which is sort of a strange feeling. But it's very impressive people. And it just so happened that the day I was doing the interviews, the fellows were having lunch with Colin Powell, who's a former fellow. And the director said, "We actually have an extra spot. Would you like to come and join us?" And I said, "Yes, of course. That would be amazing." And this may sound hokey, but after I had that luncheon, I had an appointment to do an interview immediately after that. And I said to the person, "Would you mind? I need to make one phone call. I just want to sort of step out for a second. Can I call my wife?" And the reason is because I wanted sort of Rebecca to be along the journey, because it's not every day I meet Colin Powell. And I wanted to sort of be very mindful of the fact that this is the key thing that breaks up marriages. It really is. A lot of the people I interviewed had failed relationships. It's sad to say. And this was the key thing. That they began flying around on private planes, and their spouse was at home, and they weren't interacting. It happened for both men and women. So it's not something that's just, you know, one gender specific. And so that's sort of a very, maybe it's a simple thing, but I try very much for Rebecca to be along with it. I also told her that I thought it was really important for her to know what was going on in my world. And so she made a regular habit. She checks my email. And so she sort of knows some of the things that come along. And she reads everything that I write. Before it's done, she's a great critic, which is helpful. But she also sort of knows what's going on inside my head. It also forces me to reflect that back. So I want to make sure that I know exactly what's going on at home and how things are going, because that's a real danger.
Did you interview anyone where both spouses are in the halls of power and in the court?
Let's see. I did. Janet and Lee Batchelor, Lee Scott and Janet Batchelor are a writing team in Hollywood, and they did the script for Batman, the first Batman, the second Batman, and they have figured out how to make it work. Most of the time, that's not the case. I think they, and then I also interviewed Roberta and Howard Amundson, who are philanthropists in Southern California. But their story is a little bit different because Howard inherited that wealth, and so it's a little bit different ballgame. More common is sort of people on sort of the upward trajectory, where both spouses have amazing degrees, have done some great things, and they find themselves there. How did they sort of navigate that? And what I found is that they found other couples who had similar kinds of lifestyles, where both spouses were sort of on the way to the halls of power, they weren't already there. And that provided a good sense of community. Yes, sir.
Could you comment a little bit on the action and the more general use of power to bring about social change? Specifically, maybe it's longevity, as opposed to, say, grassroots or grassroots change or something like that. And how do people in order to perceive what they were doing and how effective it would be, what actually their legacy would be?
Yeah. It's interesting because, including the people in Washington, including the people who had spent their lives in politics, almost every person I interviewed said that politics is not the place where you actually bring about cultural change. Instead, they say politics is basically the ratification of popular opinion. And instead, they identified some of the gatekeeping sectors of American public life, arts, entertainment, media, and the academy, as sort of being the places where real sort of innovation and change occurs. And then I talked with some of my friends in political science and in history, and there's a sort of consensus among these different groups I talked with that aside from sort of the civil rights legislation of the 1960s, it's very, very rare for new cultural change to actually be birthed on Capitol Hill. That most of the time it's occurring on the outer fringes and sort of percolates into political power. In order for power to actually work, so I have sort of a complicated model that I haven't talked with you about that was in a scholarly journal, but basically what it requires is the right allocation of different forms of capital, of there being not just financial capital that goes in, but human capital, the right kind of people. There also being social capital, the sort of networks that are involved there,
political capital, being able to sort of bring those kind of connections and having that capital deployed in strategic places. Now, one of the things that I make an argument sort of in my book is that the reason why evangelicals have succeeded in recent years is not really because of what they've done in politics. It's because they have built what I call sort of an infrastructure for long-term change by investing in the next generation. Evangelicals have built hardwire into their system to try and want to help the next generation, right? They want them to come to faith in Christ. But also, there's a growing awareness that that also might entail having your faith be brought into your professional life. And there's, over the last 15 years, quite literally, there have been hundreds of different initiatives that have been launched from New York to LA, from Miami to Seattle, that are trying to help younger believers sort of integrate their faith into what they do in their professional life. And that, I think, is a critical element of long-term culture change. Yes, ma'am. How many folks that I interviewed were minorities? So I sort of follow the scholarly literature that recognizes that black Protestantism is, by definition, different than white evangelicalism on the whole. So it's a pretty white crowd that I have interviewed. I did interview, there's about 8% of the people I interviewed would be people of color, but they're going to white churches largely. So that part of the mix. I actually have slight over-representation of women relative to where they are in the halls of power. Most of the scholarly literature shows that it's probably about 7 to 8% in different sectors. And interesting, because the United States is actually way down the list of the number of women represented, for example, in the national legislature compared to other countries. The one sector where women tend to be slightly more represented is in Hollywood, and that's of course because their beauty is part of the cachet of power. But the reason why I have overrepresentation is because I really wanted to get more of the stories of women to see if I could find some common points. And there are some interesting common points that I sort of talk about in the book, but I'll just mention one, is that when I ask the question about what has your faith cost you personally, every single woman I interviewed talked about challenges with their family relationships. And that was not the case for every man. There seems to be something hardwired into women that this is a point of great existential challenge for them, whether it be childbearing or spousal relationships or other kind of family relationships. And that was a real dividing line, that women, we know women work what's been called the second shift. They work all day and then they come home and they work all night at home. But among even CEOs, among even the women whose husband stays home with the kids, I had one woman who said, I feel like a schlep, because I'm never around for my kids. I don't get home until 9 o'clock at night. And that's a point of deep grief. Yes, sir.
I was wondering, to what extent have you looked into the sort of class issue, the dynamic whereby we tend to segregate ourselves by social status. Mm-hmm. And your story of Victor Voss is I'm actually from there. Mm-hmm. But have you done any looking into strategies that certain people have used to avoid the kind of isolation that seems almost endemic to being in this position?
Yeah, it's a great question, Randy. And of course, yes, I have, because class is sort of the main variable I'm sort of looking at in this particular work. And there are two things that have proven to be helpful. One is local church involvement, that was a tremendous antidote to sort of having that kind of element. And the second was an intentional decision to live beneath their means, so that they decide, I'm going to live on, instead of live on all the money I make, I'm going to live on 40% of what we make, and then we're going to save and give away the rest of it. And a number of the people I interviewed actually are doing that. There's one person who I interviewed who he's living on 10% of what he makes. And you say, well, he's probably making $10 million. No, he's not. And he's driving a car that's, you know, 1995 Saturn he's driving around in. And the reason is because he said, I just don't want to have that corroding influence that affects not just me, but my kids. And so they decide, I'm not going to move to bigger houses. I'm not going to move to nicer neighborhoods. We're going to sort of stay where we've been. And those two things have helped people sort of keep on the straight and narrow more significantly. Yes, sir.
Yeah.
You mentioned Rick Warren. I wonder if you had a chance to talk to him about the case Warren versus Commissioner and how that might have prepared him to become a national or international leader.
Yeah, I don't know this case, Warren versus Commissioner, sorry.
So maybe I'll talk to you about it after we're done. Okay. We'll take a lot of time to explain.
Okay, well, no, I don't know that. The interesting thing about Rick Warren, I had an interview set up to do sort of an in-depth interview with him, and I got a phone call and got bumped because Dan Rather needed marriage counseling. you just realize I'm sort of running in a whole different league.
John, you have a question? Yeah, sure. You mentioned that a lot of these leaders struggle with feeling like they're on a treadmill. Did you talk to ones that had specific examples of where they chose to get off that treadmill and how they reached that decision?
I did. A number of the people that I interviewed did, in fact, make that decision, more so in business than in other sectors. So different business leaders, and they're really inspired here by a guy named Bob Buford, who wrote a book called Halftime, and many of them sort of say they decided they sort of wanted to make that transition, even if they were not 50 years old. Some of them said, I want to make that change at 36 or 38. And oftentimes it was sort of a confluence of different events that came along in their life, and part of it was a sense of real longing for the sense to make a difference, that they wanted to have this, they wanted their energies to be poured into something they felt was really significant. I felt like what Dean Van Dusen said last night is very significant. The business leaders that I interviewed who were most satisfied with what they were doing were ones who could say, the product I'm selling, the thing I'm making, makes a difference in the world, contributes to human flourishing. If they could not come to that point, there tended to be more dissatisfaction. So figuring out a way how, at the very fundamental level, what you're doing can resonate with your core convictions is very important. I think we have time for one more question. Yes, sir.
Is there a difference in the practice of the women with spouse long discipline when a woman was connected?
It was more complicated. Is what happened. So, and typically, I found that this was oftentimes the case because the woman was working and the husband might stay at home to try and take care of the kids. And the dynamic is very different. The halls of power are dominated by men, and they're not very accommodating for women in a whole variety of ways. But it's most pernicious among those people who are also deep Christians. Because there are a number of sort of accountability groups, spiritual support groups that are male-centric. That there's no room for women. And this is what sort of makes it complicated. And so I'm thinking, for example, of one woman who was CEO of an insurance company in Connecticut. And she really found it to be quite a challenge to sort of help her husband come along because in many ways sort of it was constantly rubbing against the larger culture of sort of she's trying to almost prove herself to her male peers, and somehow the bringing the husband along might look like a form of weakness. And so she talked about this kind of tension. There's another woman, Tammy Hines, who's president of Borders in Ann Arbor. She told me sort of a similar story about the challenges that they faced in particular with sort of trying to negotiate those sort of gender norms and how you accommodate them. The one thing I can say is that the situation is actually getting better. So my study looked at developments from 76 to 2006, and there's a lot more positive, hopeful signs of people who are genuinely, frankly, running the halls of power, who are also trying to deal with Christian faithfulness. And so if there's any one thing I would say to you is that, let's pray for those folks who are in those positions of authority and power, and also try, in whatever advantages happen to come your way, to be a good steward of that, just in the way that we try to steward the money. Let's try to steward the power and influence we have in a way that honors God. It's been great being with you all. Thank you very much.
Somebody snuck out of this room and went to the other seminars and said, you've got to hear what Michael Lindsay's saying. He kept bringing in more and more chairs and he filled every seat. So let's thank Michael again. Our next seminar time begins at 3:30, and Michael's going to be here again in this room doing a topic, Understanding the Times, which is about the topic of discernment. So, as you can see, very popular, so come, you know, don't leave the rooms, come early. But thank you so much for being here.
Yes. Let's see your list of the
wanting to have a
No, this is not right. You can say, okay. So both of you are in Dallas.
There's a good Christian thing here.
I had a housemate from Christian, graduated from life. Another friend from that area. I'll be free after. I can regain my freedom after February. So I can now.
Well, you should definitely, while you're in the U.S., travel.
So I used to go out weekly. Mom was not strong enough to get her wheelchair out of the house. So I would take Rachel out of the wheelchair.
Now it's just so different.
I just saw them turn as a band.
Mostly in the East Bay. Well, mostly East Side. So, New York, D.C.
I've met them in D.C.
Last I heard, she was running a marathon or something. She's amazing. She's just got like this fire. I was at a conference in Rome several years ago, and I heard this voice. I just got off the plane, and this was Francis.
What are you doing here?
Really?
It was really weird. This was like a long story. And it just turned out she was on some random vacation with a man who was there for I was there for a conference too. So I kind of toured around Rome with her because I got yesterday. Her and man. I felt like a third wheel, but it was the band kind of had this like. And Rachel's like, oh, well, why don't you join us for like? And Ben had this kind of. I didn't even know him. So Ben had this kind of expression. That was the first time I met him. And he had this expression on his face the whole afternoon, like, why don't you invite him along? I felt really bad.
I think it's funny because, you know, Rachel is similar. She loves to invite people. And I think he's not accustomed to that. Because I remember she's saying that, like, you know, when they were living in D.C., like, she got to know the bus driver, I guess, going to work, or maybe he could be a terrible witch. But anyway, so she invited him home for the bus driver for just different people that she knows. You know, it's just, it's very cute. And it's neat. You know, she's so lovely.
Yes, very, very, probably the person with the greatest gift of hospitality
I know.
Because I just got that when I was on sabbatical there, I just found that I was very lucky. I met that. By the people that were there before I was I didn't know anybody. So that was cool. So things are good. Things are good. The job is great. But that's just so I can track it.
Actually, there's more going on in Pasadena than sort of actually Claremont.
Probably as sleepy as that.
It has the small town.
So maybe I will try to get a friend to touch with you.
Yeah, I'd be happy to chat.
sure you find it really lovely.
And at the very least, I might really find it this year. Just so many good things.
Which one are you going to next?
I was thinking maybe of the old Lizard and the maybe I may do that too. It's hard because we all know when it brings up a
lot of time. HD, CD,
you should have gone.
My rule is if I know somebody in this track and I know her, she's going to give me a scoop so I can get another one.
Always a good plan.
Is that right? You're going to tell me what happens. You're going to tell me what's going on here so I can get another one.
Well, I think I'm going to pop out just for a bit. But it's so great to see you.
Yes, great to see you too.
I'm sure for the second one, but it sort of came out of the woodwork.
Oh my goodness.
It was wonderful.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Not in the library, but I might have